Hello, Frank Shines here today. I'm the author of Let In But Left Out, and I'm joined with my co-author.
Grandison Shines.
Hey, Grandison, how you doing today?
Pleasure, always.
Well, everyone, it's Sunday, November 15th. A lot of stuff in the news we're going to touch on here in just a moment. But today, we're going to focus on two of the chapters of the book, Let In But Left Out. The first is Let In Coronavirus, But Left Out Bioscience. And it's not to say that we left bioscience out completely, but we think there's some opportunities that we could have done better, should have done better, and probably some areas that we still have an opportunity to learn from and do much better in the future. And then we'll do the chapter on thought leadership. Grandison was the lead on that chapter, did much of the research and the writing of the chapter. So some really interesting tidbits of information that we'll share with you guys from that chapter and how it ties into the coronavirus and bioscience chapter. So absolutely. With that in mind, let me ask you, Grandison, what's been going on in your neck of the woods? How's the last week or so been? You're out there in Arizona. I'm out here in Florida.
It has been an interesting week, and it is all over the place. At this very moment as we are speaking, we have the coronavirus surging here again in Arizona. That may be the same in other areas as well. We have schools about to shut down again, once again, because of the surge. Fortunately, my daughters have been taking the, we've been taking the remote learning piece, opportunity, and therefore we're just going to keep plugging away during that time. We have, of course, the elections just passed, and we have the president-elect versus the president who will continue to be for another 4 years, depending on who you're talking to. Now, I don't have any difference in as far as from my friends who are both Republican and Democrat, both staunchly so, and they both have their opinions right now. And it is interesting to hear the opinions. I try to stay out of it most of the time, especially on when it talks about on social media. But it's evident of who has the electoral votes, but there are still some that feel that Trump actually has an opportunity still that will, and you hear all the conspiracies around us. You know, there's a lot of conspiracy theory right now, starting from the current president all the way down to those at the local level who are, again, just all over the place in their thought processes. So it's very, very interesting. Taking a step back and looking at it from the outside looking in, it's very enlightening.
Just, you know, to your point on the like the numbers, the differences, right? So here's Associated Press. And for those of you who are listening in via audio versus watching the video tape, on the far left showing Joe Biden, Associated Press, as of today at 290 electoral votes, Donald Trump at 232 electoral votes. And most of the other media have reported Joe Biden at 306 versus 290, having given him 16 of the electoral votes from Georgia. So interesting to see how this is all going to ultimately shake out. I think the data is pretty clear that typically we don't have a perfect number in terms of electoral votes and in terms of the full population vote. There's an official vote count. There's early projections, which is what we're talking about right now. But looking at those population statistics, right, the vote count as opposed to electoral votes, that's coming in at almost 79 million for Joe Biden and just about 73 million for Donald Trump. So that would represent 51% of the electorate versus 47% of the electorate. So showing Joe Biden at 51%, roughly 4 points higher than Donald Trump in terms of the popular vote, the overall population vote. But again, clearly over the 270 mark at 290 or 306, depending on whose figures you look at. So that's an interesting thing around the data, which is going to bring us right into the conversation in a moment here. As we look at the coronavirus and we kind of walk through the scientific approach to solving complex problems, where we always start with defining the problem and measuring with data. But also, you're saying, yeah, the uptick in the number of coronavirus cases as well as deaths, right? And I remember, you know, when we were writing the chapter during the lockdown, and we were going back and forth, working around the clock on the different chapters for this book, and to include the one that we're gonna be speaking about today. I remember those numbers, you know, hovering right in the neighborhood of, you know, 700, 800, and then every once in a while you get 900 to 1,000. Now we're 1,260. Right. I think we were over 1,400 per day a few times last week. So clearly things have gotten worse.
Yes, and, clearly over 100,000 new cases total in all states. It's been,
So numbers showing right here on the data that we're looking at for those of you who are listening in. Total cases at 11 million, over 11 million, 11.2 million. And then the total deaths at 251,256. And then we've got a running number of new cases on, you know, 24-hour clock that we're looking at here as well. Okay, so yeah, the same thing out here, out in the East and the Midwest and so forth, we're seeing big jumps, increases in number of coronavirus outbreaks. And a lot of this, really, the big challenge is, you know, you have to always think about where's my key bottleneck. The bottleneck becomes overwhelming your healthcare system, overwhelming the nurses and ICU units and the doctors, right? There's only so much talent that can take care of people. So once you hit the peak ability for those folks to handle more and process more individuals, then automatically your death rates are going to climb quite high because you just don't have... You know, the you don't have the bandwidth, the capacity within the system to manage all of those people who are getting infected and getting hospitalized. So, okay. Absolutely. So here's another interesting thing that happened for me this week. Grandison, you and I, we've talked a bit around some of these things when I went back and spent time for about the first 4 months of, I can't keep track of the years anymore, 2019, last year. In Philadelphia, spending time with a lot of military high-tech vets, folks from CIA, all branches of the military, FBI, and so forth, looking at a lot of the latest things that were happening from the perspective of new information technology and security systems, technology systems for companies, as well as, you know, things associated with social media and the cloud and all of this. And stayed in touch with another key individual that... that's a part of the military network, you know, from the Air Force Academy, really, really good friend. He's one person removed from President Trump. He won't go into any specific details, but I had a chance to catch up with him. We've been talking back and forth as I've been writing the book and updating the book and got his initial thoughts on the first early release of it. And so I had a chance to catch up again yesterday for about 45 minutes while I was out at the pool while the girls were playing. And, it was a really interesting conversation that I think ties right into some of the two topics that we're talking about today around lead and coronavirus, but left out bioscience and then the fault leadership. So let's go right into the chapter. So what this individual told me that kind of ties into coronavirus bioscience, he's been traveling around the world for the last several weeks and recently got back into DC. And in fact, at the time that he was there, he was, you know, letting me know that, well, it looks like some things are happening, you know, right around the White House right now. The increase in the protesters that were out there, pro-Trump protesters were out around the White House. So letting me know that, you know, at any moment he might get interrupted. He might have to go out there and make sure things are going okay and that they don't turn violent. The good news is things stayed quite tame, but there was a little bit of violence towards the evening, I suppose, from what I understand. But things never really got too far out of control. But as he was telling me that, he said, you know, this is obviously one of the key things we've got to address as a nation. And that is, you know, how do we help people understand? And this is an individual who spent time traveling around the world like myself, to include in Asia. And he said, yeah, people in Asia, they wear masks, right? Even before we had coronavirus, people in Asia, you know, they would wear masks to protect, you know, protect their fellow citizens, right? He spent time in Japan. I spent time out in South Korea and China and Japan. And we both saw the same thing. So as ex-military people, this is not a surprise that people should wear masks, particularly, you know, if you could do it when you got a little flu or a cough out in Asia, and certainly, you know, when you have an epidemic, a pandemic on your hands, you can certainly wear masks. So he was just really struck by, you know, coming back again to the country and seeing the polarization around mask wearing. certain things that, you know, I think all of us can probably agree to. So that was an interesting conversation. Then from there, we talked around some things that relate to kind of the overall leadership and what we can do about it as a country. But let me pause there. Any initial thoughts you have on any of that?
No, I hear you talking about the mask wearing. And one of the things I question, just hinging on that really quick, is the thought process of some people of why we shouldn't wear a mask.
Right.
And you hear all kinds of excuses and or reasoning behind it.
Oppression.
Exactly. That you hear that it's from a medical standpoint, they have some sort of nuance about themselves, that asthma or some other respiratory issue. You hear that the mask actually causes pneumonia and other types of the virus to stay in there, and you get to, and so there's a lot around that. But when you look at just some of the information data, like we were talking about, and science behind it,
right?
If you think just on a scale of common sense, it's more about, hey, why don't we do this in order to protect someone else from that standpoint? You might not be a carrier and or super spreader. You might not be susceptible to the virus, and you may be asymptomatic, but are you, and we have to ask ourselves, are we that so far removed from other people and that selfish that we don't want to wear a mask because it's all about me versus me protecting someone else? If I can, if I can cause someone else to get ill, I mean, what if they die? I mean, what if you have that on your conscience? So there's a lot around it, but it's mind-boggling how some of the mindsets are in terms of why they should not wear a mask and still thinking this is a hoax and whatnot. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, looking at this survey they did about 2,500 people, and you know, they give some of the example anecdotes, 77-year-old man in his response, which is typical of some of the overall data findings. And he said, people wearing masks were probably driven by political scare tactics, yeah. Adding that he didn't know anyone who had contracted the new virus, right. The new coronavirus, right? So yeah, just a lot of different things that people will say as it relates to the mask. But yeah, at the end of the day, why can't we, sacrifice maybe just a little bit for ourselves, a little discomfort for ourselves to save the life maybe someone down the street from you, a neighbor, maybe a teacher, particularly a healthcare provider, right? Those that are being impacted this, and these nurses that are dying in hospitals because of some of us who choose not to wear a mask. But so that was an interesting conversation with this individual. But jumping right into the approach that we've taken in a chapter, what we do in a chapter, both with regards to the coronavirus chapter versus bioscience, as well as fault leadership, is we break it down into some specific steps that you can take. In the first case, we look at the scientific approach to solving any type of complex problems, whether they're people problems or engineering problems, typical business problems, whatever it might be. But first of all, we define what the problem is, we measure current state of that problem, we analyze, and we want to analyze in order to get to the root cause, the core issues of the problem, so we're not solving the symptoms, which is the most difficult part. And once we identify what those core or those root cause issues are, we come up with solutions that impact directly those root causes, not the symptoms. And then finally, we put in place control. So we call it DMAIC, D-M-A-I-C, is kind of an acronym reminder. We define it, we measure, we analyze it, we improve, and then we control the problem.
Right.
And so if we were to apply that, and we lay it out in the book chapter, Let In Coronavirus But Left Out Bioscience, where we say, first of all, okay, let's define the problem. What is the problem? And it can be defined in a number of different ways, in just kind of high level terms. We can say that the problem is that, right, we have a certain number of coronaviruses cases and deaths and hospitalizations that are occurring, right? And so you can define it in terms of, in the last, say 3 months, we've had an average of 1,000 deaths per day across the United States. And that is the equivalent of however many cases and hospitalizations. And therefore we say that's a problem, right? We would not want to just continuously have 1,000 people, which is akin to having a 9/11 event every 3 days in this country, right? I mean, we wouldn't stand for that. So we should not stand for that today, particularly if there are ways it can be addressed, right? If you can't fix it, if there's absolutely no way, we have no clue, and there's nothing we can do about it, you know, our hands are tied, I get it. If it is what it is, and we're living, you know, in 14th century Europe, I get that. Maybe you can't do anything about it. You don't have any science, you don't have any information, you don't have all the technology and advances that we have today. But today we do have those. We have skills, we have tools, we have experiences from others as well as ourselves. And so there's no reason that we should have to have 1,000 or more people die every day. Right. So that's a definition. Anything to add to the define phase there, Radisson, from your perspective?
That's a very critical phase in understanding what it is we're dealing with. To get as much knowledge, garner as much knowledge as you can about what it is and defining what that problem is. Because as we wrote in the book, there are times where even people in the same department may have a different outlook on a particular issue, right? I mean, they haven't defined the problem, and they may not even think there's a problem, and they communicate differently. So I believe that's one of the most important aspects of this particular process, is making sure you really define the problem, but even more importantly, make sure that everyone is on the same page about what that problem is.
Yeah, perfect point. You know, in the book, as we go through the define phase, you know, we reiterate that point about the only way that you can clearly define the problem in a way that you're going to be able to solve it is you've got to get input from multiple perspectives.
Absolutely.
And they have to buy into the understanding of what that problem is. Yep. Because if they don't buy into it, they're not going to support any solutions. And they certainly aren't going to support some of the next phases in terms of measuring it and analyzing it if they don't even believe that it is a problem.
Absolutely.
Right? And which is an issue here, right? Some people don't believe it really is a problem. And so the first question is, how do we help convince others that may not believe, you know, it's anything other than just, you know, the flu?
Yeah, the flu.
How do you show, right? And there's data, right? We go into the chapter, we talk about, you know, we look at the number of data points around a typical flu. If you're looking at the data points, I remember the first thing that people were saying, well, it's no different than just, you know, number of car accidents. And we live with a certain amount of car accidents, but we don't shut down all the roads and everything when we have a car accident.
Exactly.
Right. That's another example where, okay, if someone has a car accident, they don't spread it to someone else and infect two or three other people. Right.
Yep, exactly.
Or a super spreader event. Right. When you have an accident, you don't automatically, you know, transfer that to and kill a number of other people that are beyond your, that are in some cases, you know, completely beyond the local area of the accident that could travel in different places.
Yeah. Travel in place. Exactly. Right. Yep.
And then we looked at that raw number. I can't recall exactly what it was, but somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 20 to 30, maximum 40,000 deaths per year from car accidents in the U.S. And if you look at that compared to where we are today, right, a quarter of a million people, it's five times the number. So this is, again, why it's so important to define. And as we define, we move often into the measure phase, the measure being, okay, what is it that we're measuring so we can define that there truly is a problem? So it's not uncommon to go back and forth. You know, we look at some of the numbers, current average of 20,000 new cases per day, right? And the number of deaths that we're seeing here. How do we also, we talked about reducing the unemployed workers and the fact that, you know, maybe you want to have a measurement around testing up to 120 million Americans by, say, September 1st. We wrote the book, obviously, back in July and August. But those are some of the things that we're measuring to see not only the impact from a coronavirus perspective, but from an economic perspective as well. Number of people out of work and how many people unemployed, those sorts of things. So that's what we do in the define and measurement phases. We try to define the problem from multiple perspectives. We get everyone to buy into the definition of that problem. And then we put in place the measurements so that we can say, okay, if these things start to go down, number of deaths, number of hospitalizations, number of people that were unemployed and now back to work, if those things start moving in a favorable direction, then we know that we are at least solving the problem. So that's why we use hard data. So that's the measurement phase. The next phase is where we go into analysis. And even in this measurement phase, you know, to clarify often before we get into the specifics of the analyze phase, we may say, let's use a simple tool like what's known as a SIPOC. SIPOC stands for suppliers, input, process, and output, and customers. So the suppliers would be things like the horseshoe bat, the pangolin, those animals that pass on the virus to a domesticated animal. So it jumps in from the input of those suppliers of, a horseshoe bat that's found in China. They then spread it to a pangolin, or perhaps it could be spread to a camel, it could be spread to a swine, a pig. And then from there, that's usually how we get it, right? Because we have the domesticated animals, and then we pick it up from the domesticated animals, perhaps during a slaughter session, slaughterhouse, and then maybe someone sniffs it or gets it in their eyes, their nose, their mouth, and that's how they ingest it. And then they've got the virus, they're not even aware of it initially because it's asymptomatic type of initial conditions for many people, especially the young. And then they pass it on to someone who passes it on to someone who passes it on to someone else. So that's in the process steps that the P of the SIPOC. So an infected person expels the virus-laden drops, someone else inhales the drops or, you know, touches their face from contact surfaces or whatever. And now it has entered the body. It goes through different stages within the body. And then that virus begins to grow. And depending on, you know, the individual, it goes past your throat and goes into other parts of your body and ultimately into your lungs and other organs. So that's the process. The output is that you have then damaged cells. You could have strokes and seizures, conjunctivitis, kidney damage, blood clots. And again, this is an example where when we take a SIPOC and when we define and measure something and help people understand is kidney damage or failure, blood pressure issues, diarrhea, blood clots, heart attacks, cardiac inflammation. When they begin to see some of these other things, it becomes a little bit more real, right? Now there's nothing like physical. Often when we look at these problems, we say, okay, let's define and let's measure, but let's now go to a site, right? In this particular phase, go to the hospital and walk around and see the people, right? Because until people see it and touch it and watch people dying, right? Sometimes it just never becomes fully real.
Yep.
So that's, that brings us to the last part.
They have to experience it themselves, ultimately.
Yes, right. Yeah. Right, yeah, excellent, good point. So now we've gone through the define and measurement phases, and then what we want to then look at is the analysis phase. But in the chapter, what we do is we talk about the importance of understanding some things around culture, because there's psychology in numbers, and there's numbers in psychology, right? In other words, if I'm fearful about reporting information about a coronavirus because in my neighborhood or my family or maybe it's your ethnic community. I know in San Francisco, I've got friends that are from Taiwan and China. They tell me that in San Francisco, there's a big stigma associated with having a coronavirus. So they won't even report amongst themselves. So we're getting underreported numbers. And then I know in cases where I was talking with the individual from the White House that I told you about, he informed me that they're concerned about overcounts, right? Where there may be some perverse incentives by healthcare professionals, doctors, whatever, to report more numbers than there really is. And consequently, there could be some overreports. The reality is whenever you look at measurements, this is why we take the time to say define and measure, is we actually train people and educate people on the fact that there's no such thing as a true figure. There's no perfect number. All there is there's a range of certainty, right? Think about that bell-shaped curve. Probably the truth is like right in the middle of that bell-shaped curve, and there's extremes of underreporting and overreporting on the ends of that bell-shaped curve, on the extreme left and on the extreme right. So the best you can do is say, on average, is the number is about this, right? And that's got to be good enough. I mean, you'll never get a perfect number. And so I think those things are important to drive home kind of the culture, because really what you want to do is you want to get people to understand and appreciate and buy into what is it that you're talking about in terms of problem. and how you're measuring the problem. Otherwise, if they think it's a bunch of psychobabble and they don't believe in it, it doesn't matter what you do in terms of analyzing and putting in place improvements later on.
Very true. The nail on the head on that one. Very, very true.
Right. So then the next phase after we've gone through, you know, kind of had that quick little point here on culture, we talk about some of the tools that can be helpful for changing minds, right? If you're trying to change minds, if this person is a data logical person, then you use what's called the white cap. So you think in terms of just the facts, ma'am, just the facts, and you give them data and logic and rationale, similar to what we've done so far. But in case maybe they just need incentives, if there's no incentive economically for them to believe what you're saying because they think they're going to lose their job and not be able to make money for their family, then you got to address the economic issues and the heartfelt issues. So this is the color of money, rewards and consequences and resources. You need to give these people money. It's not that they don't believe, but if they have no incentive to believe something that's true because they have an economic hardship that's going to result, don't be surprised when that happens. Right?
Very true. Yep, absolutely.
The black cap. So that's when maybe people, you know, we call the black cap because color of darkness, maybe your eyes are closed, you won't move. Maybe you're paralyzed, you're not sure what to believe, or you just don't believe it. This case, this is where you may have to make the status quo painful. This is a case where maybe they just have to go through it and see it themselves. Absolutely. Or have someone they know or a loved one die before they really believe. Or perhaps they've got to, you know, if you can take them to an environment where they can see it, or ask them, well, what would it take for you to believe? And do whatever is necessary to help them from that perspective. That's the black cap. The red cap is the heart and passion, right? So this is where, again, the heartfelt stories and so forth and analogies and parables. So maybe certain people don't understand all the science and biology. It's very confusing. But if you can show them, you know, the equivalent of, you know, like a Hollywood picture in slow motion showing how a virus is spread, a way of seeing, you know, here's someone sneezing and here's how it slowly spreads to people around the room. And you can see it in slow motion with special effects, those types of things. Then that's a way to kind of help people understand some of the complexity, understand the issue without having to understand all the complexity as described by an epidemiologist or a biologist or someone who uses a lot of strange, you know, crazy language. And then the yellow hat and blue cap. The yellow cap is for sunlight. So you got to bring in and clarify, make the future fuzzy. So this is the example where you say, if we do these things, here's what will happen, right? If we shut down the virus, we can open up our economy, right? So help them see the future and where it can be. And then finally, the blue cap is the color of the blue sky, meaning it's non-threatening. And this is where sometimes you just have to respect her point of view. You're not going to be able to convince them immediately. Acknowledge and respect what they have to say. And then over time, you may be able to nudge them a few degrees at a time, but you're not going to, you know, you're not going to be able to get everyone to agree to everything you say. And that's part of also the richness and power and the of the diversity of this country, right? It's part of what is the strength of our nation. So we have to be willing to take the good with the bad, and the bad with the good, as they say. The rainbow cap just means you can use any of these caps at different points in time. So that kind of brings us through all the cultural things. We talked about, you know, measuring the current performance so that everyone understands exactly what's going on and you can communicate that to them. We went in and we looked at that at the point that we saw the data June 15, 2020, as the book went to publication. Total deaths were about 435,000. Total number of infections worldwide was 8 million. And total U.S. deaths at that point was 117, almost 118,000, about 2.2 million cases. And so we tracked a lot of this information to include, you know, the infection rate, the fatality rate, the number of people who had filed for unemployment. It was 38 million U.S. workers had filed for unemployment in the first 9 weeks of the coronavirus pandemic. Those are the things we looked at to understand, here's how we define the problem, here's how we measure it, here's how we understand the people and cultural aspects of things. And then we moved into analyzing root causes. So before I go into the analyzed root causes, anything else from your perspective, Grandison, that relates to the Mayic up until this point?
Yeah, the one, especially the one part of the black hat and you're talking about pain, and that's what people need sometimes. There's two things that that we learned in martial arts, two things that can bring about change. One is pain, one is knowledge, and the other is pain. And right. I remember very, very vividly, Sifu kept telling me to put my thumbs in. And I'm likening this to some of the things that we may have to go through regarding the coronavirus at this point in time with different thought processes and different people. He kept telling me to put my thumb, bring my thumb in, put my thumb in. So one day.
So like when you're putting your fist or what?
Yes,
what
do you mean? When you make a fist, right. Make right. sure your thumb is tucked underneath the fingers appropriately versus having the thumbs out. And that's a very common mistake that beginners make. But that's also a mistake that you have to really make sure that you manage, understand proprioception, where your body is, and judge it or work from that standpoint. So one day he just told it to me so many times that he by this time it was time to institute pain. So I remember he grabbed my thumb, pulled my thumb all the way back, and I'm all the way down to the ground now. He said, "Put your thumb in."
Right? So I can't, you got it.
Yeah, so that day forward, I have never had my thumbs out and punching again. But that's what happens, unfortunately, to some of the people regarding the coronavirus. There are people who were anti-mask and anti-information, and they got it and they put it on social media. And so one guy even died as a result of it. He was going through his experience and jotting, putting the lessons learned through his experience until the point he died. Now, that's extreme. We don't want that, but people can mitigate that just by understanding, bringing the knowledge and operating in this sort of mindset we're talking about here. But some people, again, the whole status quo may have to be painful in order for them to understand, unfortunately.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. You know, in the military, that's the way they train us, right? I remember, you know, the first week in pilot training, one of the first weeks of pilot training where we were learning about what's known as spatial disorientation. And we talk about this in the book, in fact. Mm-hmm. And so they don't come in and talk about the engineering and science and physiology of what's known as spatial disorientation, where you lose your sense of where your body is in the air and relative to the earth where your plane is. And that leads to death. It's one of the highest causes of death for pilots. But rather than explaining all that stuff, I remember we walked in the room and you know, the instructor was really quiet. He just walked up, welcomed to class, turned around, and he turned on a loudspeaker. And for the next roughly about a minute, we heard the sound of what it's like to go down from spatial disorientation from a former F-15 pilot, and hearing all the calls on the radio that went back and forth before his crash, and he died. And that was it, right? They just, you know, now all of a sudden you got everybody's attention. Yeah, what do I need to learn? How fast do I need to learn it? What do you need me to do, right? But that's what they do. They slap you in the face. They punch you right between the eyes to get your attention. Yeah. Sometimes that's what some of us need, unfortunately.
Yeah, we learn the hard way, unfortunately, sometimes. We can learn by someone else's experience, learn faster and resolve the issue problem faster as well.
Right. So in the analyze phase, what we talk about here is this is the biggest problem that happens. Most organizations, if we think define, measure, analyze, improve, control, right? So think DMAI. Most people, they don't even have to define a problem. They jump to I. And that's the critical thing that we see go wrong in most organizations. Because if you haven't defined a problem, that means you don't have buy-in. So no one's really going to believe it except the small people who are going to be doing the most of the work on it. You haven't measured it. So whatever happens, good or bad, you can always say it was good or bad because you didn't measure it. And you don't have any way of objectively comparing what you did later to a baseline, right? And then analyze. Analyze is the biggest thing that gets neglected. Most organizations do not step back and take the time to think, to just really stop and think and to imagine. Because sometimes part of doing root cause analysis, you have to imagine things perhaps that you don't know. There are certain things about a coronavirus, they don't happen very often, right? A big epidemic like this doesn't happen. So you have to use your imagination. A 9/11 event doesn't happen every day. So you have to use your imagination. But that means stepping back and really analyzing all the potential reasons for what is really at the core of the problem. So during in the coronavirus thing, we go through here and we talk about one tool that you use, the six M's. It's a cause and effect diagram. So you try to figure out, here are my causes, what's my effect? Your effect is the problem that you defined in the define phase. And now you start asking, okay, well, what's the problem around machines? You look at ventilators, you look at high testing machines, you look at materials. Well, how about the disinfectant, Clorox, bleach, the protective equipment, the gowns and gloves and booties, right? I know you're laughing about the disinfectant. We'll turn everyone's attention to some of the YouTube videos out there on that. Collection of supplies and swabs and transportation, Mother Nature, temperature, humidity, sunlight, all these things, environmental factors, manpower and woman power, age, gender, illness, comorbidities, people who are immune compromised, people who have different points of view about belief and not belief in the virus, methods, testing, contract tracing, social distancing, sheltering in place, isolation, quarantining, the use of masks in public. And then finally, different types of measurements, like the number of cases, number of tests, the number of intubations and hospitalizations and treatments and vaccines and unemployed workers. So those are the things that we have put up on a visual cause and effect diagram. And then we start asking ourselves, you know, well, why is this happening around this thing, around this thing? And we ask ourselves why five times. Why is this, so why are people not wearing their masks? Well, because of this. Well, why is that happening? Well, because of this. Well, why is that happening? Because of this. And then you finally get to the root core cause of the problem. You're not solving like symptoms of the problem. And now once you get to the I phase, the improvement phase, you got a much greater chance that whatever improvements you put in place are going to be hold, they're going to fix the problem, and they're going to be long-term sustainable. So that's that brings us to our improvement phase. And then once we go through improvements, we put in place improvements. And I think most of us know some of the improvements, the short-term things around improving our lot as it relates to the coronavirus, right? Things like just washing your hands, cleaning surfaces, wearing masks in public, maintaining social distance, isolating the high-risk individuals, keeping social gatherings to, you know, less than 10 or 25 people, sheltering in place. Those are some short-term things. The midterm things would be, you know, how do we start looking at completing a COVID testing of a certain number of Americans per week? How do we conduct passive disease surveillance so that we can identify outbreaks? How do we start initiating the testing and rollout of a pre-vaccine therapies, as well as the research around a vaccine? Those would be midterm types of improvements. And then longer term improvements, obviously, is, you know, ultimately developing a vaccine. And we've seen some really great news around that with BioNTech and Pfizer. Most recently last week, that news that came out showing 90% effectiveness with this initial vaccine. There's still a lot of things that have to be worked out. Once all is said and done, that number may not be as high as 90%, maybe 70 or 60 or 80%, but still that'll be quite an improvement.
Absolutely, no doubt there.
Any other input, comments on the analyze, improve phases there, Branson?
No, I believe that gives people a very strong 10,000 foot view of how why this process is such an important piece in resolving these complex problems. Absolutely, yeah.
And in the control phase, because we're so new into this epidemic, we didn't go into all the details around in the control phase, but what we've done is we put that information up on a chapter on the website. So if you go to letinbutleftout.com and just you do a search on DMAIC, for example, then you'll find the information. What we'll do is continue to update this because, you know, things are changing quite rapidly.
Hell yeah, absolutely.
As it relates to this epidemic. So so there's the DMAIC chapter. You'll see there COVID, DMAIC, Letin Coronavirus, Left Out Bioscience. And there you can just go online. You can see the data around, you know, the trends of different states with respect to the virus. You can see the images that we created to show how viruses are spread amongst bats and across the different swines or camels or pangolins, from SARS and MERS all the way up to present day COVID-19. And then we just kind of walk through the SIPOC model and all the other tools and methods that we were hitting on earlier. Talk about the culture change components of of things in organizations and measurement. So as we start getting further into the improve phase and start seeing initial vaccines roll out, then we'll add the control phase to this this page on the website as well. So there's an overview of what the chapter is about as it relates to let in coronavirus, but left out bioscience. We're gonna shift our attention to the fault chapter. I'll turn it over to Grandison to kind of walk us through what does the fault acronym stand for and how to apply it for something like the coronavirus. So turn it over to you, Grandison.
Absolutely, and I'll talk about this from a 10,000 foot view as well. One of the, let me mention a prelude, what I'm about to talk about with this. What we usually talk about, what's been happening, I feel, in the corporate environment, in organizations, if when they talk about leadership, a lot of times we talk about the skill sets that a leader has or should have, being resilient, and they teach this. And I've been in a lot of these leadership courses throughout my tenure in the corporate arena, and they talk about mentoring, coaching, and presence, and decision-making, those types of actual skill sets. But one thing that I have found that has been omitted is the actual process. And we talk about this in the book,
and this
is the process of leadership. So I liken it to if you want to bake a cake, you go to the store, you take the cake mix off of the shelf there, and you look on the back and you see the ingredients, right? You see you need egg, you need oil, you need the contents in this box, you need blah, 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 right? Those are the skill sets that we have. Now you look further down, then it talks about the process of actually how to actually make the cake. Put all the contents in the bowl, put them in and mix them up and preheat your oven to 450, 350, whatever it may be, and oil your pan. So they give you the process. Well, we need to have the same thing in the corporate environment. That's why we came up with the fault leadership process. And I'll take you through the steps as you see right here on the screen. First of all, we have to make sure that we find the knowledge. And this is why the DMAIC chapter, when we talk about the letting coronavirus with the bioscience, is such an important chapter in the book, I feel, because it lays out the process. And anytime you have a process, if you operate in the process correctly, you should get the results that the process is mandated that you're going to have. And that's the importance of just not haphazardly going, say, for instance, to the eye, like you were talking about, Frank, just going to the improve and not gather all this information out. Well, leadership is the same way. When you're leading people, when you are trying to manage difficult situations, when you're trying to inspire others to take action, when you're trying to develop a team, when you're trying to solve complex problems, when you're trying to increase growth, it's the same thing when you are a leader. So finding the knowledge is extremely important. That's what the F stands for. A, act and communicate with empathy and communicate. When you act, and you should be communicating as well, listening and talking, both going back and forth. Act with empathy and integrity. That's one of the first things we have to utilize and come to an introspection point of that we are going to act and we're going to communicate with empathy and integrity, all in truth in the matter of what the knowledge that we found. Don't skew the data by changing it or whatever it may be, whatever the problem is that you're trying to resolve or whatever you're trying to develop, stick with the empathy and integrity. Ultimately, you're not a leader if you don't have any followers. So, and leaders delegate. So we have to delegate because you can't do everything yourself. And this is one of the biggest issues we find in the corporate arena. When we're doing our leadership training with communication, accountability training, a lot of times the leaders, and Frank, you may attest to this as well, leaders just say, I'm going to just do it myself because I can get it done faster or whatever, right? And you see that all the time. And they don't have they're not taking the opportunity to delegate to subordinates in order to make sure that one, when you take it away from the subordinate and you do it yourself, you're not giving them the opportunity to learn and grow and mature as well. So that's a detriment to the mindset and the organization as well. But you have to delegate for this change and through critical mass. So we have to figure out making sure we utilize that as a step in the process. And then you logically scale and sustain the change. Anytime leaders are always, always, always dealing with change. So even in the third process, the third step in the process, ultimately you can delegate for change. We're changing something all the time. We're changing something. You're trying to solve a problem, guess what? You're trying to change the status quo. You're trying to increase growth, you're trying to change the status quo where you're at right now. you're trying to manage a difficult situation where you're trying to change the status quo. So change is ultimately something that we're going to be dealing with all the time. You're trying to inspire someone to take action. Guess what? You're trying to change the status quo. So you have to logically scale that as well, roll it out appropriately, sustain, and put in measures to sustain the change. And then, of course, you have to throw a party. You have to tout those wins. Even more so importantly, make sure you celebrate even the smallest of wins and document lessons learned. The smallest of wins. It doesn't matter how small the win. It's worth noting, especially if someone did something that was very advantageous for the group, something that can help the process along, make sure you mention that. And that's one of the things that us leaders have to like in terms of what we're doing. Now, superimpose this process over the coronavirus. Absolutely. Our leader right now, President of the United States, should have taken this process and understanding. But I tell you, Frank, and we've seen, you don't get the knowledge. You don't define the problem. We were talking about that first step is so critical. It's so critical. And we have to be able to get out of our own way and listen to those who are more of an expert than we are in that particular area. It is imperative to surround ourselves with people who can, and leadership and resourceful. So we should find those people who have expertise in that certain problem, that certain nuance, and lean to their understanding, their wisdom, their insight, their knowledge.
Right.
And work from that standpoint. So that's the process from the 10,000 foot view. And when we're talking about coronavirus, we have to communicate. We have to act and communicate with empathy and integrity. We can't, I understand not wanting to cause mass hysteria in the economy, but we have to be empathetic. We have to talk with integrity. We have to be real and truthful and authentic about what it is, how we're acting, and what it is that we're communicating. That has to be definitely one of the aspects. I'll open it for anything you want to interject right there, Frank.
No, I like what you've done. The whole idea about the recipe, right? You got ingredients, mm-hmm. But what order do you mix them in, right? You've done both here. You said, okay, here are my ingredients and here's the recipe. Follow this, right? And will you get it right 100% of the time? No, but you'll dramatically increase the odds that you're going to get it right, right? You probably, by a factor of 5, 10, increase the chances that you're going to get it right. And that's a powerful part of what you've laid out here. Yeah, that whole part about defining knowledge and acting with empathy with respect to coronavirus, Brett, because it's such a delicate issue that you've got to get the right people around you, and you got to get people with multiple perspectives, not just quote unquote the doctors, but also the communities in the tribal areas of this country that have been decimated, right? 90% of their population killed off over the last 400 years in this country. They're going to have a different take on things, right? You got to understand where they're coming from, and the people who are in those communities where maybe any type of outbreak or virus is seen, in such a negative light with a stigma. You've got to talk with those people and understand where they're coming from, because ultimately, as you act with empathy and integrity, if you don't reach out to the people and understand where they're coming from, then you can't take that empathetic viewpoint. That empathetic viewpoint is having grasped a perspective of the knowledge from someone else's, from someone that's maybe not like you. And that's where the empathy really comes from. And then that integrity is so critical, like we were talking about even earlier. The example with the pilot training thing, it's integrity. They don't care. You may not like it. It may be painful, but it's better to have the pain and be truthful with people. And ultimately save more lives than to be nice and have more lives lost.
Absolutely. And that's an important piece that we have to realize. And then you get into delegating to those expert leaders, breaking up into different silos and understanding how they can have an appropriate seat at the table with the diversity that we're talking about, with different ethnicities and different expertise, and utilize that to continue to resolve the problem. And scaling, having the appropriate solution and scaling that solution, test out some things first before just launching it out, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, testing it out. And realizing that, okay, we got the positive result we want, or can we improve on it a little bit more? Okay, can we go back to the table and try to improve it a little bit more? Okay, fine, test it out again, and then scale it and roll that out to sustain that change. And then, of course, which is also omitted step number five, throwing the party, understanding and celebrate those successes in small wins. Can't emphasize that enough. And that needs to be something that will even keep the energy, the thought energy and the momentum and the fervor and the motivation and inspiration to continue on. You need that portion of it, acknowledge those and give kudos where it's rightfully deserved as well.
Yeah, I you know, you hit on something there in that last point in terms of the importance of, you know, even doing it in the short term, which helps, you know, to think about this model as iterative, right? It's not like a toll gate. I find a knowledge and I have no more knowledge I'm going to find. Now I act with empathy. There's no more empathy. Okay, now I move to the next step. No, it's iterative, right? So yeah, you may, exactly. In order to ultimately scale and get more people, we're seeing this in companies around the world, right? That before the boss thought they knew it all and did it all. Well, guess what? They can't even travel around the country and around their plants anymore. So they have no choice but to delegate. The individuals that before would say, there's no way anyone's ever going to work for my organization unless I can see them right here in front of me. Well, guess what? You got 50% or 70% of your workforce that's now working from home. You better learn how to delegate in a different way than you've ever done before, right? You have no choice. So yeah, we're seeing this in organizations as well as, you know, on the larger scale across the country. And in order to kind of, you know, to Grandison's point on the party part, if you celebrate the incremental improvements that they make as, you know, you delegate, they're going to grow in confidence. They're going to feel Absolutely. Better about themselves. Absolutely. And they're going to try to do more for the organization and for the team and for you. So yes, there's no reason why you can't do that in incremental fashion. And then as they learn and you logically scale, maybe you throw another party. Okay, here's party number two. Here's the big trophy now, right? You got the small ribbon, right? You got the little... Starbucks gift card. Well, now you get the big trophy. Now you get the bonus, right?
All right. Yes. Yeah. That's an important piece. It's very, very important. And again, going back to the whole process, the make process, thought leadership process, I feel that companies can tap into this. There's a unique opportunity right now for companies to tap into this because we are disparate as an organization now, and most of the organizations are, at least. They have an opportunity to utilize these two processes and even grow even more and even develop a new culture within the organization that can be very, very beneficial, not only for them, but also their customers as well.
Excellent point. Yeah, the intersection of these, you can take finding a knowledge, a big part of finding a knowledge is that DMAIC. So use that DMAIC as part of the way of helping you find knowledge and then execute the AULT as part of the rest of the thought leadership program. Excellent points, Grandison. I like the way you summed that up. Let's shift our gears to one other topic before we close here, and that is, what can people do about this, right? What's the average person, given the challenges that we're facing as it relates to coronavirus and relates to, you know, adjusting to the COVID environment, this new normal, as they call it, maybe it never really goes away, in our families, in our organizations, in our communities, what are some of the thoughts that you might have for people listening?
Sure, I'll name three and then we can talk about these independently right quick. One is to make sure that we stay engaged, and that's from a very high level. Two, bring down rhetoric, bring down the current temperature environment where we are.
Oh, yeah. Three,
yes, absolutely. And then three, show respect in others that have different opinion and thought process from you. You can still be respectful and still have a difference in the opinion. We can agree to disagree. So those three things, stay engaged, bring down the rhetoric and show respect of others and despite of our differences. So stay engaged.
That's Go ahead. Yeah, you know, so I was thinking on that one to begin with. You know, we were looking at the information a little while ago around the election, right?
Right.
And those numbers, I mean, that's historic. Roughly 73 million from Trump and approaching 79, 80 million from Biden. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So before, I think no president had gotten more than 69 million votes. I think that was the previous record, roughly. Right. So that's a big part that indicates, you know, Americans, you know, they stepped up this time. They showed they were not going to be apathetic about the future. In fact, they got engaged this time. And yeah, so how do we sustain that moving forward? There's some real discussion going on behind the scenes, Homeland Security and the military, across government, back in the White House, you know, some of the conversations I was telling you about earlier, they're really looking at how can we make elections easier and simpler for people and safer, right? In case we ever have additional outbreaks and things like this, or perhaps maybe it's going to take much longer to get everyone to agree to, you know, get vaccinated, because that's a big issue. They're already seeing 40 to 50% of people saying they wouldn't become vaccinated, even if we do have a vaccine around coronavirus. So this thing could be lingering a little bit longer. So there's been a lot of discussion around, you know, other ways we can use technologies, make the equivalent of a smart ballot through your phone that's also verifiable, in other ways that we can ensure the integrity of that data and so forth. So a lot of that discussion is taking place right now to ensure that people remain engaged moving forward. So we don't have, you know, this just kind of fizzle away like oftentimes it has in the past.
Right. Yeah. That's going to be increasingly important. And staying engaged from the leadership standpoint, which can continue on and us individually. Yeah. It's going to be a work in tandem on that note, in order for both sides of the coin to stay engaged.
Right. Yeah. I think the media's got a role to play here too. You know, you're talking about the respect piece that ties in there, and I'm jumping a little bit ahead, so we'll go back if you want, but the stay engaged impacts this respect piece, because if you don't respect people, then people are not going to feel engaged. They're not going to feel that the things that are important and that matter to them are being addressed. And I, you know, as I listen to this media, and we touch on this in the book, right? It's kind of like you get online, or you get on a TV, or you go online, or whatever, you hear two extremes, right? Trump is good or Trump is bad, right? Or exactly. The latte liberals, right, are the death of the country, or the alt-right will bring us down, right? It's just these loud extremes on either side. But yeah, I think it's important that the media and all of us have to play a role, like you say, in bringing down the rhetoric and really respecting each other. And then I think, you know, the opportunity, you know, for bringing in more people and keeping people engaged, you know, if they don't have this fear that they're going to be, you know, bullied online and so forth. I think there's a greater chance that we can get more of the moderate folks that are willing to speak up, but not if they feel they're going to get, you know, if they'll be alienated by the extreme.
And that goes into, in both what we're talking about here, as far as respecting the difference and bring down the rhetoric there. And you mentioned the word bullying, and we see it all the time. At least I see it all the time in my feeds on different social mediums, is that there are some cyberbullying going on. Someone has a different opinion, and no one can take that as being subjective, that it's their opinion, and that we can just roll with it. It's not that you have to disagree to the point of being brazen to someone else about something and acknowledge and dealing with it in a different way, in a way that's inappropriate. But you can agree to disagree. If you don't agree with them, then one of the things we have to do is maintain self-control and be able to just bite our tongue when we have a difference in opinion and take that, or even be, or even more so in terms of something that could be enlightening, is being open to the other person's thought process and understanding, seeing it from their point of view.
Excellent point. Well, listen, for those of you who are listening to the audio podcast, this has been me, Frank Shines. For those of you watching on video, that's me on the left, and then my big little brother, Granison, on the right. And this has really been a joy to speak with you guys about the chapter, Lead in Coronavirus, but Left Out Bioscience, and the great work that Granison has done on the Fault Leadership chapter in the book, Lead in, but Left Out. Any last comments, closing remarks from you, Granison?
Yes, encourage everyone to we have an opportunity, if you haven't already, grab the book, and there are really strong pieces, nuggets and truths and wisdom pieces, everything you want that you can utilize to grow as a person, not just from a professional standpoint, but also from a personal standpoint. The book is full of wisdom, knowledge, and understanding in these different areas.
Well, I'm going to close on a very interesting and positive point. as Granison said, the audio and video, video, it will be on YouTube, and the audio, you can come to our podcast on the Led In But Left Out website and go to podcast to listen to this. This time, well, let's see, I would say this time last year, but everything's all messed up because of the coronavirus. This time last year at the Masters, Tiger Woods came back and won the Masters in just a stunning performance, went all the way to the end. This year, he's going to be handing that green jacket off. Who to whom, we are not sure, but chances are good it'll be Dustin Johnson. It'll be great to see him win. Carolina boy who just he just rips it and makes it look easy. But this is one he's wanted for a long time. And so hopefully we'll end on a nice positive note. And the tie-in there is to Granison's comment about, you know, this ongoing professional and personal development and growth. When you look at Tiger this year, he's just walking around. He's not going to win, but he's got a big smile on his face. He's reaching out. He's caring more for people. So he's not just a professional athlete now. He's showing that other side of him to his fans, you know, the real heart, the soul of what it's like to be a human being and a father. So.
Fantastic. Awesome.
Thank you all. Have a great day. And this has been Frank and Granison.